Thank you. Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. I'm going to have the marshal call the first case, please.
Please come to order. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Riley, Judge Johnson, Judge Jessen, the Honorable Denise D. Riley presiding, calling the case of In Re Custody of KCDC, court file number A210493.
Thank you and good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. We'll conduct this hearing like we would if we were live. Each of you will have 15 minutes and the appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it. Please mute your mics when you're not speaking. It helps prevent the feedback. And if at any time you have technical difficulties or can't hear us, raise your hand and we'll stop and take that or make sure that your time isn't counting against you. Would you please introduce yourself for the record at the beginning of each of your portions of your arguments? And with that, are you ready to proceed?
Yes.
Thank you. You may then, Mr. McIntosh.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. My name is John McIntosh, and I represent David and Nancy Simon in this matter. May it please the court. This is a life-changing situation for my clients and the child at issue in this case. And while the facts are really undisputed in this case, it's a matter of how we apply law to it. In all of my research, I believe this is a case of first impression. And from the perspective of what we really have here is two de facto custodians. And that raises some unique issues in this case. I look at this case from the perspective of what I refer to as front end and the back end of the case. And then from the side perspective, and that is that the family court always sits in equity. And the ultimate effect of the court's the district court's decision that this is not equitable. And on the front end of the case, there's really two considerations. One is, were the Simons entitled to notice of the proceeding? And then two, were they entitled to intervene in the proceeding? The statute is not entirely clear when you have two de facto custodians.
And Mr. McIntosh, there is the case law out there, at least the case law we were able to find. You brought your motion under Minnesota Rule of Civil Procedure 24.01. And it seems to me in reading the Valentine case and the Van Merveren, maybe I'm pronouncing that incorrectly, case, that wasn't the proper procedural vehicle and the judge dismissed it because a child is not an interest or property. How do you think you can go forward under Rule 24 in light of those two cases?
I'm happy to address that, Your Honor. I understand the Valentin versus Lutz and the Van Merveren line of cases. I don't believe those are controlling here. What I do believe is controlling is the Halverson versus Taflin case, which cites the Tischendorf case, and also the very recent Supreme Court case in Miller, which is cited in my brief. The Halverson decision from the Court of Appeals, or a precedential case, specifically addresses both the limits and the inclusiveness of Rule 2401. And it highlights what it referred to as the extensive procedural protections and demands of the equal protection and due process constitutional provisions that guard against erroneous deprivation of parental rights.
I'm just looking at your brief. I don't see the Halverson case cited in it.
Your Honor, the citation to it is My apologies, I don't have it at hand. I will get it for my rebuttal purposes, but it is this is, you know, in rebuttal to the issue that was raised in Mr. Van Curra's brief with regard to citing only the Van Meveren cases, not the line of cases under Halverson and Tischendorf. And the Halverson case specifically looks at the issue and question that you're raising, Your Honor, and that is, and it talks about a number of cases involving Valentin involves a foster parent. And the court concluded that Rule 24 didn't apply there. Van Meveren involved a sibling. And the case cited for Hennepin County versus Brown is just wildly off base and deals with a situation with a grandmother bringing a second action 5 years after the fact. In Halverson, the court prioritized, and Halverson is a domestic abuse case where the court specifically determined that a non-party in a domestic abuse proceeding whose rights were impacted in that proceeding was allowed to intervene, and they specifically held that Rule 2401 applied in that case, and they distinguished between, again, the limits of Rule 24 and the inclusiveness of Rule 24. And essentially, the takeaway from that was that you need to take a look at the individualized facts and circumstances in the case, which the court did not do here.
It seems that the procedures or the way for custody in these kinds of situations to work is that you proceed under 257C, where it talks about de facto custodians and third-party custodians and all of that, and that you file a petition or you have to file a petition under that in order to proceed.
I don't agree with that, Your Honor. And in the Halverson case, where they allowed intervention and they said intervention is, you know, appropriate in that situation. In that situation, there was under the Domestic Abuse Act, someone's rights were interfered with for 1 year. The term of the order for protection. Here it's permanent. And so this case, I believe, is even more compelling. And I think you have to read those line of cases in conjunction with the recent Supreme Court Miller decision. I think that is very instructive on what needs to happen here. And in that decision now, and I understand that that decision dealt with financial interest or a property interest in a particular case. It wasn't a custody case. However, and a very important thing to note is that in the Miller decision, the court emphasized Rule 24, and I quote, seeks to protect persons who claim an interest relating to the property, and I emphasize further, or subject at issue in the litigation from having that interest adversely affected by litigation taking place without their participation. Now, I emphasize or subject because the Van Meveren line of cases talks about and specifically uses the term or transactions, okay? And in that case, the language is limiting language, and it's limiting to, you know, essentially civil cases, which is what the Van Meveren line of cases talks about. Now, that is emphasized here is that it is the subject at issue. The subject is his child, or the subject is child custody. And the Miller decision specifically goes on to cite Avery versus Campbell to explain that the rule is intended to allow a person claiming an interest to become a party, and here I quote, to prevent judicial processes from being used to prejudice the rights of the proposed intervener. Now, that's exactly what happened here. And
Mr. McIntosh, if I may?
Yes.
I want to take you back to something you started out talking about. You said it was a case of first impression, and because there were two de facto custodians. And then you talked about your clients were entitled to the notice of the proceeding. I assume you mean the 257 proceedings. But I don't see that issue just in the issues you raised before us, you know, directly, you know, brought to our court. It seems more, and tell me if I'm wrong about this, that you're kind of making that notice more as an argument about why your client should be allowed to intervene. Is that fair? Because I'm just not sure the notice issue, as you set it out, is before us.
Well, I think it is, Your Honor. And the reason for that is, obviously it's a fundamental proposition in the law that if someone's rights are adjudicated, they're entitled to notice and an opportunity to be heard. In this case, my clients received neither of those. And we raised this issue with the district court and believe that it's necessary and fundamental to this. And there is no adequate record for this appeal that addresses whether the court even thought about that. They just went straight to the back end of the case and said, well, this is a modification situation and you don't meet the endangerment standard. I think that's in error, both substantively and procedurally. You know, when you look at, the authorizing statute, 257C, specifically subdivision 3, it does give some notice. And obviously there's nothing out there that any of us can find that say, when you have two de facto custodians, here's what you need to do procedurally.
Let me ask you this question. I was able to find Helverson, even though you didn't cite it in your brief. And Helverson is about parents. We have grandparents here. Helverson talks about a parent's liberty interest in their children and says that the failure to grant a parent an opportunity to be heard on custody issues is a denial of equal protection and due process. And I am unaware of any case law or any statute that talks about grandparents' liberty interest in children and grandchildren in the same way that our case law talks about a parent's right to parent. Are you aware of any statutes or case law to support your leap that Helverson applies to grandparents?
Yes, Your Honor. My response, well, and first off, Helverson is 617 Northwest 2nd, 450. And what also differentiates this case, and I think the importance of Helverson and what it talks about, it, you have to look at the unique facts and circumstances. And where my clients are differentiated from generic grandparents or a sibling or a foster parent, such as in the Van Meveren cases, is that they are recognized as de facto parents or de facto custodians, which is a statutory right. And the court's decision recognizes, or the consent decree itself acknowledges that the Simons provided, that the minor child resided with the Simons half the time. And that it was that half the time that the child also lived with the Vanderheidens, which gave them standing as de facto custodians. And so they are situated equally relative to this child. And another paramount interest here is, of course, the best interest of the child. But so what happened is they simply went behind Mr. Simon's back and did this with no notice, which is not fair and equitable. And essentially, and in effect, adjudicated his rights without an opportunity to be heard, or without even notice of it. And so I submit on that basis, the order itself is not valid. I think that they were necessary parties and notice was required. And it's just simply not optional. Or, you know, when you read the broader picture of again, I think the Halverson case, as well as the recent Supreme Court decision, which is more inclusive and lends itself to a higher level of inclusiveness. And so I think that's what is controlling here. The purpose of it, you know, what happened here was, you know, people used litigation by stealth and prejudiced someone's rights that clearly has an interest. Now, if you look at Rule 24, my clients absolutely have an interest. They meet the criteria.
Sir McIntosh, your 15 minutes has run. So if you would please conclude your thoughts and you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I think that the appropriate remedy in this case is to simply reverse and remand allow the Simons to intervene and we can properly adjudicate the best interests of the minor child. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Attorney for respondents.
Good morning. Please the court. My name is Franz Van Kura and I represent the Vanderheiden respondents. I want to begin by how we got here. KCDC's biological parents transferred custody to the Vanderheiden respondents via third-party consent decree pursuant to Minnesota Statute 257C07. Now, if you read the language of that statute, it tells you how, it says you can do it. It doesn't say who gets notice or that you have to serve anybody. The consent decree is an agreement between two parties. In this case, it was the biological parents and the Vanderheiden respondents. And the biological parents elected to transfer custody to the Vanderheiden respondents. That's how they got sole legal and physical custody. I agree with Justice, I think it's Jessen's comment that notice isn't properly before the court, but even if it was and the court is inclined to entertain the notice issue, 257C07 simply doesn't require notice to anybody. It's basically a contract between the two parties. 4 months after the transfer of custody to the Vanderheiden respondents, appellants filed a motion to intervene as a matter of right pursuant to Minnesota Rule of Civil Procedure 2401 and the custody consent decree case, to which they were not a party. And herein lies the issue, as the court has already questioned Mr. McIntosh about. Beginning with the Supreme Court, Minnesota Supreme Court's decision in Valentine, and then this court's Court of Appeals decision in Van Meveren, the courts have consistently and inveterately held that non-parties can't use Minnesota Rule of Civil Procedure 2401 to intervene in family or child custody matters. Children and child
custody. Can I take you back to something you just said? Because I'm going to say it troubles me a bit. I mean, your point that 257C doesn't require notice, and you said then it's basically a contract between parties. And I just am struck by it, whether it's in a child protection setting or a child custody setting, you know, courts generally have, you know, an obligation to look out for the best interest of children. You know, here we're dealing with a three-year-old, right? Are you saying that there's, that the judge here had no obligation to look out? All it was is we're just implementing a contract between the parties? Because I find that hard to follow.
No, Your Honor, the court could only approve the third-party consent decree if the court finds that it is in the best interest of the children. It's a statutory requirement. So what the parties do is they agree, okay, the parents want to transfer custody. Well, then you have to go before court, which happened, and there was a hearing, and the judge has to review the facts and circumstances and decide that, yes, it's in fact in the best interest of the children to transfer custody and approve it. And that's exactly what happened.
It's, how does a judge consider the best interest of the child when in its own order it says that the child is spending, you know, half the time with appellants, and, you know, they're not before the court? I'm just struggling to follow that.
Well, I think it has to do with the parents have a right, can choose to transfer custody to a third party, which is what happened here. That's what the law, the statute says you can do it, and the court approved it. And to my knowledge, nobody has attacked the validity of the third party consent decree, and that the validity of it is not an issue on appeal right now. So we have to go with the fact that the Vanderheiden respondents obtained custody via the third party consent decree, which was approved by the district court, because their parents wanted to do it. And such transfers are lawful and statutory.
If I may follow up on this point, I'm looking at 257C, and consent decrees are provided for in 0.07, that section of the chapter. 0.03 is the statute concerning procedure, and subdivision 3 talks about written notice. Are you saying that subdivision 3 of 0.03 does not apply to a request for a consent decree under 0.07?
Correct. And there is unpublished case law that that agrees with what I'm about to argue. So the third party consent decree under the subsection 07 is an independent means to transfer custody. What the subsection 03 deals with is de facto custodians or third parties, interested third parties, how they come about getting custody of a child.
And I see 0.07 in the first paragraph has a best interest requirement built into it, but I suppose that then that's the information the district court has may be limited, because the only people present before the court are the parents and the recipients of the transfer.
Correct.
Okay, thanks. Correct. Mm-hmm. I have one question about the procedure in this case. I believe the consent decree was the district court approved it in July of 2020, and then the motion to intervene was filed in November, 4 months later. Had judgment been entered after the July order, was it an open case or a closed case at the time of the motion to intervene? And does that matter to us?
I'm going to just go and pull up the...
Right. Well, we can find the district court record and review that too. I was asking, just based on your familiarity with the case, whether you had a quick answer. But...
Yeah, I mean, the third party consent decree just ordered the district court ordered transfer of custody to the Vanderheiden respondents, and that was the end of it.
There was no need for it's the type of matter or type of proceeding in which there is no judgment typically entered.
Your Honor, I went by what the statute said. There's no forms for this. There was, I originally drafted it, and the court approved it.
I guess maybe it's fair to say that as far as I get the sense that you were not expecting any further proceedings. You considered the matter done and with a result in your client's favor.
Correct. You know, and as a side, I'm not sure it really matters, but since 2009, my clients had temporary custody via designation of parental authority that the biological parents had executed in their favor.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Do you agree with Mr. McIntosh that this is a case of first impression, since it involves two sets of grandparents who each had shared informal custody of this child?
I really don't, Your Honor. And the reason being is the Hennepin County versus Brown case that I cited in, or that the respondent cited in their brief, it's almost the exact same fact scenario. And the appellants in that case tried to distinguish their case from Van Meveren and Valentin because they claimed that they were de facto custodians. And the court said, no, it doesn't matter. You still can't intervene under pursuant to Minnesota Rule 2401. So I really don't think there's anything novel about this from a legal standpoint or a factual standpoint. And this is all part of the factual record, but obviously the two parties here were formerly married to each other. And, I think the appellant, when they found out that the biological parents wanted to, chose to transfer custody to the Vanderheiden respondents, felt hurt and angry, and then tried to impermissibly intervene. And if you think about where we are procedurally, if the court follows Valentin and Van Meveren and that line of cases, it's just proven law that they don't have standing. They're appealing from that custody consent decree.
If I can take you back, Mr. Van Kurek, you were talking about answering Judge Riley's question about, is this a case of first impression? And you pointed to the Hennepin County versus Brown case, but my recollection of that case is it's a non-presidential or unpublished back in those days case. So is there kind of a governing case clearly presidential that applies to this that is published?
Well, I in terms of whether or not you can intervene as a matter of right under Minnesota Rule 2401 in a child custody case, yes, it's Van Meveren and it's Valentin.
I want to understand how you think that Mr. McIntosh's clients could come to court. And as I understand your brief, you're saying that after 1 year, they could file a petition under 257C. They were as third party custodians or de facto custodians or something like that. But pursuant to 518, they would have to, custody could only be modified by a showing of endangerment. Is that what do you think their way forward is?
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor. Yes, the procedure would be for them to file a petition for third-party custody under Minnesota Statute 257C03. That's how you do it. And the thing is that there's a dual requirement. First, you have to satisfy the pleading requirements of 257-03. And then there's a further requirement that you have to, 257-03 has its own three endangerment factors. So you don't actually even have to get to 518 to get 18 to get to the endangerment statute because it's already contained in 257-03. And whether it's 2 years, the point being is that if they want to obtain some sort of custody, they're going to have to allege facts which show that KCDC is endangered under the current custodial arrangement at any point in time that they try to do this.
Mr. Bancura, I'm looking at, thank you for that answer. I'm looking at 257C.06, which is just one sentence saying the procedures in section 518.18 for modification of a custody order also govern modification of an order under this chapter. Based on that sentence alone, I'm unclear whether that means that section 518.18 applies if there's first an order under 257C and then there's a later motion to modify, or whether it means that the action under 257C itself triggers section 518.18, or whether perhaps it includes both of those. Do you have do you have an answer, and if so, any authority?
I think so, Your Honor. So if it's an initial custody determination, like for example, let's say the biological parents died suddenly, and you know, two competing third parties petitioned for custody of the surviving children. That initial custody determination would be wholly contained within the parameters of 257C.03. But in any subsequent attempts to modify a custody order once established under 257C, you have to go over to 518.18.
So, and then if I look down to 0.07, in the last paragraph of 0.07, it says a party to a consent decree under this section may file a motion to modify or terminate at any time. Then there's a reference to 518.18. So it seems like that would preclude appellants. It would have precluded appellants from filing a motion to modify or terminate the consent decree.
Correct, because they weren't parties to the consent decree.
Okay, so then, and I understand your argument to be, though, that the district court properly got to 518, the endangerment standard within 518.18. Do I misunderstand you there?
Yeah, no.
And if so, I mean, how does the district court get to the endangerment standard in 518.18 in this case?
Well, because what the district court did was treated it as a motion to modify custody, and which essentially was. And if you just read that portion of 257C.07 that references 518.18, you have to allege endangerment. I mean, that's what the legal standard is under 518.18.
Is the word endangerment or danger in, it's in 0.07 itself? You earlier referred to 0.03, but I'm looking for it now in 0.07.
Well, so it says section 518.18 paragraphs D and E apply to all modifications. A party who has custody of a child under this section must seek modification of the consent decree before transferring physical legal custody to anyone. And then if you go to 518.18D, that's where you get the endangerment language.
Okay. Well, maybe I misunderstand and I apologize, but in this case, how do the appellants even get to 518.18 if they're not a party to the consent decree? Because of the first sentence, I mean, it seems to me that the second sentence, which says 518.18 D and E applies, refers back to the first sentence, which says a party to the consent decree may file a motion to modify.
Yeah. So they're back to 257 or yeah, it's 257C.03 is the only means they have, proper procedural means to, so to speak, attempt to obtain custody.
And can you be specific about 0.03? Are you looking at under subdivision 2, the requisites of the petition? And
yeah, I mean, I know it's a lengthy, but you know, it's entitled procedure. So if you go through the entirety of this, the subsection there, one part talks about for de facto custodians, I believe, and the other is for third party custody. And there's a, the Lewis Miller line of cases, there's a basically a two-part test here. First, the court would look at by a preponderance of evidence, whether it's in the best interest of the children to have third party custody. But then the other part of it is that you have to also allege one of the three endangerment standards contained within this 257C03. So there's an endangerment.
And which part of 0.03? I'm trying to find that.
Okay.
It's the endangerment language that you're referring to. And I'm sorry, I don't not been able to find it yet.
Seven. Paragraph 7A. Yep. To establish that an individual is an interested third party, the individual must show by clear and convincing evidence that one of the following factors exist. And then it lists three factors, all of which are require some allegation of endangerment to the child.
Okay, so thank you for that. So now, but I guess, I think this goes back to my prior question. It seems to me that if the district court was required to do some sort of analysis of whether the child is either in danger or has been disregarded or has been harmed, it seems to me that that analysis is done within 257C, not under 518.18 in the context of this case.
Initially, yes.
Initially.
But, well, see, that's...
So your brief, I mean, cites 518.18, but I just don't see the... I don't see how the district court's analysis would leave 257C and go to 518.18.
It's because, Your Honor, the language says that you can only modify a custody consent decree pursuant to the standard contained in 518.18. It doesn't reference 257C03. So you don't... there's no way to get to this motion to intervene. And then if you look at the consent decree statute, it doesn't tell you to go back to 257.03. It puts you over into 518.18. That's how the district court got over there. I mean, and the thing is that there's an endangerment required under the third party or de facto custodian. That's the 257C03. But that's an initial pleading requirement, more or less. If that makes any sense.
Thank you, Mr. Ventura. We let you have more than your 15 minutes. So Mr. McIntosh, do you have any rebuttal? And we'll give you a little more time if you need it.
That's fine, Your Honor. Yes, I do. What I would like to follow up on your line of questioning, Judge Johnson, and to indicate that this is not a third-party custody case. This is a de facto custodian case, and that is very clearly distinguished under 257C. And so I think it's leading down the wrong path to say that we ought to look at this as a third party custody case. It is not. And
Mr. McIntosh, I mean, would you agree that before your clients sought to intervene, the other parties were proceeding under 0.07 custody consent decree?
Yes.
And then you sought to intervene in that case rather than filing a separate a petition to initiate a new case.
That's correct.
Okay, you may.
And obviously our notice of motion to motion put everybody on notice. It was absolutely clear what we were there doing. I think to follow up on, again, your line of questioning, if you follow Mr. Ventura's logic, my clients have no remedy. No remedy. Or if they have to come in later under a third party custody action, it has an entirely different standard, an entirely different procedure. And it also presupposes that my client's rights were adjudicated, okay, to, you know, to modify an order that you were not party to, it simply flies in the face of certainly fairness and equity, or the best interests of the child. And
Mr. McIntosh, you said that this is a case of first impression. And so what would syllabus point be if we were to make this precedential?
Well, one of the things that I would do is I would distinguish, Mr. Van Kura indicated that the Brown case, because it involved a grandparent somehow, Justice Jessen indicated, okay, that's not a precedential case. But I would say it's very distinguishable to begin with. And what happened in Brown was this was a grandmother that came back 5 years after she brought a de facto custodian case and lost. She sought another bite at the apple when one of the biological parents initiated a custody case. So the facts are not applicable here at all.
Mr. McIntosh, so you heard me ask your opposing counsel some questions about, it seems like the 0.07 proceeding was finished. It had reached its conclusion. So, I mean, did you, in conjunction with your motion to intervene, was it your intent to file something like a motion to vacate, or did you file a motion to vacate? Was that your intention? I mean, what relief could you get in a proceeding under 0.07 that had reached its conclusion?
Well, we did argue before the district court, Your Honor, that this order should be vacated. And we provided in the alternative, well, there's another way to look at this because there's no clear roadmap. But to get to—
And then if it were vacated and reopened and the district court were to consider it anew, what relief would you ask for in that proceeding?
Well, we'd ask to intervene for one, or if procedurally it became necessary to file a petition, certainly we would do that. But what one important point is that 257C, the procedures in 257C are akin to the procedures in 51818, but they're very different. This is a statutory right. And I think you put your finger in the right place, Your Honor, with regard to my party was not, my client was, clients were not parties to the action. And accordingly, their rights were not and could not be adjudicated. And so, we come back to sort of the, some of the fundamentals. And I would point out that 257C3 subdivision 3, it does talk about notice to a person that substantially contributes to the support of the child. It specifically references the person is openly living with the child. These are points that I think are applicable in this case. Whether you look specifically through 257C or look broadly through, the family court sitting in equity, because on the bottom line, it is not fair and equitable that my client's potential rights were completely extinguished without his notice or participation. That needs to be vacated. The case should be remanded so we can deal with this properly and start over as may be necessary. Thank you.
Thank you very much. It's an unusual case in that we have a child who appears to be loved by a number of adults who want to care for him. And often that's not the case that we see in these kinds of situations. So, thank you for your arguments and your briefing, and we will get our decision out within the 90 days.
Thank you, Your Honors. Have a good day.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you.